The Book of Werewolves by Sabine Baron Gould. An Adult Brain audiobook production. Read to you by Graham Dunlop. Chapter 1. Introductory. I shall never forget the walk I took one night in Vienne after having accomplished the examination of an unknown druidical relic, the Pierre Labbé, at La Rondelle near Champigny. I had learned of the existence of this cromlech only on my arrival at Champigny in the afternoon, and I had started to visit the curiosity without calculating the time it would take me to reach it and to return. Suffice it to say that I discovered the venerable pile of gray stones as the sun set, and that I expected the last lights of evening in planning and sketching. I then turned my face homeward. My walk of about 10 miles had wearied me, coming at the end of a long day's posting, and I had lamed myself in scrambling up over some stones to the Gaulish relic. A small hamlet was at no great distance, and I betook myself thither, in the hopes of hiring a trap to convey me to the post-house. But I was disappointed. Few in the place could speak French, and the priest, when I applied to him, assured me that he believed there was no better conveyance in the place than a common charrue, with its solid wooden wheels. Nor was a riding horse to be procured. The good man offered to house me for the night, but I was obliged to decline as my family intended starting early on the following morning. Out spake then the mayor.
Monsieur can never go back tonight across the flats, because of the...
And his voice dropped.
Le loup-garou.
He says that he must return, replied the priest in patois.
But who will go with him?
Aha, monsieur le curé. It is all very well for one of us to accompany him, but think of the coming back alone.
Then two must go with him, said the priest.
And you can take care of each other as you return.
Picou tells me that he saw the werewolf only this day se'night, said a peasant. He was down by the hedge of his buckwheat field, and the sun had set, and he was thinking of coming home, when he heard a rustle on the far side of the hedge. He looked over, and there stood the wolf as big as a calf against the horizon, its tongue out and its eyes glaring like marsh fires. Mon Dieu! Catch me going over the marais tonight. Why, what could two men do if they were attacked by that wolf fiend? It is tempting providence, said one of the elders of the village. No man must expect the help of God if he throws himself willfully in the way of danger. Is it not so, Monsieur le Curé? I heard you say as much from the pulpit on the first Sunday in Lent, preaching from the gospel.
That is true, observed several, shaking their heads.
His tongue hanging out and his eyes glaring like marsh fires, said the confidant of Picou. Mon Dieu! If I met the monster, I should run, quoth another.
I quite believe you, Cortez. I can answer for it that you would, said the mayor.
As big as a calf, threw in Picou's friend.
If the loup-garou were only a natural wolf, why then, you see,
the mayor cleared his throat,
you see, we should think nothing of it. But, Monsieur le Curé, it is a fiend, a worse than fiend, a man fiend, a worse than man fiend, a man wolf fiend.
But what is the young monsieur to do? Asked the priest, looking from one to another. Never mind, said I, who had been quietly listening to their patois, which I understood. Never mind. I will walk back by myself, and if I meet the loup-garou, I will crop his ears and tail and send them to Monsieur le Maire with my compliments. A sigh of relief from the assembly as they found themselves clear of the difficulty.
Il est anglais?
Said the mayor, shaking his head, as though he meant that an Englishman might face the devil with impunity. A melancholy flat was the marais, looking desolate enough by day, but now, in the gloaming, tenfold as desolate.
The sky was perfectly clear and of a soft blue-gray tinge, illumined by the new moon. A curve of light approached its western bed. To the horizon reached a fen blacked with pools of stagnant water, from which the frogs kept up an incessant trill through the summer night. Heath and fern covered the ground, but near the water grew dense masses of flag and bulrush, amongst which the light wind sighed wearily. Here and there stood a sandy knoll capped with firs, looking like black splashes against the gray sky. Not a sign of habitation anywhere, the only trace of men being the white, straight road extending for miles across the fen. That this district harbored wolves is not improbable, and I confess that I armed myself with a strong stick at the first clump of trees through which the road dived. This was my first introduction to werewolves, and the circumstance of finding the superstition still so prevalent first gave me the idea of investigating the history and the habits of these mythical creatures. I must acknowledge that I had been quite unsuccessful in obtaining a specimen of the animal, but I have found its traces in all directions. And just as the paleontologist has constructed the labyrinthodon out of its footprints in marl and one splinter of bone, so may this monograph be complete and accurate, although I have no chained werewolf before me which I may sketch and describe from the life. The traces left are indeed numerous enough, and though perhaps like the dodo or the dinormis, the werewolf may become extinct in our own age, yet he has left his stamp on classic antiquity. He has trodden deep in northern snows, has ridden roughshod over the medievals, and has howled amongst oriental sepulchres. He belonged to a bad breed, and we are quite content to be freed from him and his kindred, the vampire and the ghoul. Yet who knows? We may be a little too hasty in concluding that he is extinct. He may still prowl in Abyssinian forests, range still over Asiatic steppes, and be found howling dismally in some padded room of a handwell or a bedlam. In the following pages, I design to investigate the notices of werewolves to be found in the ancient writers of classic antiquity, those contained in the northern sagas, and lastly, the numerous details afforded by the medieval authors. In connection with this, I shall give a sketch of modern folklore relating to lycanthropy. It will then be seen that under the veil of mythology lies a solid reality, that a floating superstition holds in solution a positive truth. This I shall show to be an innate craving for blood implanted in certain natures, restrained under ordinary circumstances, but breaking forth occasionally, accompanied with hallucination, leading in most cases to cannibalism. I shall then give instances of persons thus afflicted who were believed by others, and who believed themselves to be transformed into beasts, and who, in the paroxysms of their madness, committed numerous murders and devoured their victims. I shall next give instances of persons suffering from the same passion for blood, who murdered for the mere gratification of their natural cruelty, but who were not subject to hallucinations, nor were addicted to cannibalism. I shall also give instances of persons filled with the same propensities who murder and ate their victims, but who were perfectly free from hallucination. Chapter 2. Lycanthropy among the ancients. What is lycanthropy? The change of man or woman into the form of a wolf, either through magical means so as to enable him or her to gratify the taste for human flesh, or through judgment of the gods in punishment for some great offense. This is the popular definition. Truly, it consists in a form of madness, such as may be found in most asylums. Among the ancients, this kind of insanity went by the names of lycanthropy, quanthropy, or boanthropy, because those afflicted with it believed themselves to be turned into wolves, dogs, or cows. But in the north of Europe, as we shall see, the shape of a bear, and in Africa that of a hyena, were often selected in preference, a mere matter of taste. According to Marcellus Sidetes, of whose poem a fragment exists, men are attacked with this madness chiefly in the beginning of the year, and become most furious in February, retiring for the night to lone cemeteries and living precisely in the manner of dogs and wolves. Virgil writes in his 8th Eclogue, written in Latin, here translated to English, "These herbs and these poisons gathered in the Pontic region, Morris himself gave to me. Many such grow in Pontus. With these I have often seen Morris become a wolf and hide himself deep in the woods. Often have I seen him call spirits from the depths of graves and shift the harvest sown elsewhere to new fields." And Herodotus,
"It seems that the Nuri are sorcerers, if one is to believe the Scythians and the Greeks established in Scythia, for each Nurian changes himself once in the year into the form of a wolf, and he continues in that form for several days, after which he resumes his former shape."
Lib. 4, 100-105. See also Pomponius Mela, Lib. 2, C1. "There is a fixed time for each Nurian, at which they change, if they like, into wolves and back again into their former condition." But the most remarkable story among the ancients is that related by Ovid in his Metamorphoses of Lycaon, king of Arcadia, who, entertaining Jupiter one day, set before him in a hash of human flesh to prove his omniscience, whereupon the god transferred him into a wolf.
"In vain he attempted to speak. From that very instant his jaws were bespluttered with foam, and only he thirsted for blood, as he raged amongst the flocks and panted for slaughter. His vesture was changed into hair, his limbs became crooked. A wolf. He retains yet large trace of his ancient expression. Hoary he is as afore, his countenance rabid, his eyes glitter savagely still, the picture of fury."
Pliny relates from Evanthes that on the festival of Jupiter, Lycaeus, one of the family of Antaeus, was selected by lot and conducted to the brink of the Arcadian lake. He then hung his clothes on a tree and plunged into the water, whereupon he was transformed into a wolf. 9 years later, if he had not tasted human flesh, he was at liberty to swim back and resume his former shape, which had in the meantime become aged, as though he had worn it for 9 years. Agrippus relates that Diminutus, having assisted at an Arcadian human sacrifice to Jupiter Lycaeus, ate of the flesh and was at once transformed into a wolf, in which shape he prowled about for 10 years, after which he recovered his human form and took part in the Olympic Games. The following story is from Petronius. "My master had gone to Capua to sell some old clothes. I seized the opportunity and persuaded our guest to bear me company about 5 miles out of town, for he was a soldier and as bold as death. We set out about cockcrow, and the moon shone bright as day when, coming among some monuments, my man began to converse with the stars, whilst I jogged along singing and counting them. Presently I looked back after him and saw him strip and lay his clothes by the side of the road. My heart was in my mouth in an instant. I stood like a corpse, when, in a crack, he was turned into a wolf. Don't think I'm joking. I would not tell you a lie for the finest fortune in the world. But to continue, after he was turned into a wolf, he set up a howl and made straight for the woods. At first I did not know whether I was on my head or my heels, but at last, going to take up his clothes, I found them turned into stone. The sweat streamed from me, and I had never expected to get over it. Melissa began to wonder why I walked so late. 'Had you come a little sooner,' she said, 'you might at least have lent us a hand, for a wolf broke into the farm and has butchered all our cattle.' But though he got off, it was no laughing matter for him, for a servant of ours ran through him with a pike. Hearing this, I could not close an eye, but as soon as it was daylight, I ran home like a peddler that has been eased of his pack. Coming to the place where the clothes had been turned into stone, I saw nothing but a pool of blood. And when I got home, I found my soldier, lying in bed like an ox in a stall, and a surgeon dressing his neck. I saw at once that he was a fellow who could change his skin, versipellis, and never after could I eat bread with him. No, not if you would have killed me. Those who would have taken a different view of the case are welcome to their opinion. If I tell you a lie, may your genie confound me. As everyone knows, Jupiter changed himself into a bull. Hecuba became a bitch. Actaeon, a stag. The comrades of Ulysses were transformed into swine. And the daughter of Proteus fled through the fields believing themselves to be cows, and would not allow anyone to come near them, lest they should be caught and yoked. St. Augustine declared in his De Civitate Dei that he knew an old woman who was said to turn men into asses by her enchantments. Apuleius has left us his charming romance of the Golden Ass, in which the hero, through injudicious use of a magical salve, is transformed into that long-eared animal. It is to be observed that the chief seat of lycanthropy was Arcadia, and it has been very plausibly suggested that the cause might be traced to the following circumstance. The natives were a pastoral people and would consequently suffer very severely from the attacks and depredations of wolves. They would naturally institute a sacrifice to obtain deliverance from this pest and security for their flocks. This sacrifice consisted in the offering of a child, and it was instituted by Lycaon. From the circumstance of the sacrifice being human and from the peculiarity of the name of its originator rose the myth. But, on the other hand, the story is far too widely spread for us to attribute it to an accidental origin or to trace it to a local source. Half the world believes or believed in werewolves, and they were supposed to haunt the Norwegian forest by those who had never remotely been connected with Arcadia. And the superstition had probably struck deep its roots into the Scandinavian and Teutonic minds ages before Lycaon existed. And we have only to glance at Oriental literature to see it as firmly engrafted in the imagination of the Easterns. Chapter 3. The Werewolf in the North. In Norway and Iceland, certain men were said to be i.e. Einhammer, not of one skin, an idea which has its roots in paganism. The full form of this strange superstition was that men could take upon them other bodies, and the natures of those beings whose bodies they assumed. The second adopted shape was called by the same name as the original shape, hammer, and the expression made use of to designate the transition from one body to another was at Skipta Hermum, or at Hamaz, whilst the expedition made in the second form was the Hamfer. By this transfiguration, extraordinary powers were acquired. The natural strength of the individual was doubled or quadrupled. He acquired the strength of the beast in whose body he traveled, in addition to his own, and a man thus invigorated was called Hamrammer. The manner in which the change was effected varied. At times, a dress of skin was cast over the body, and at once the transformation was complete. At others, the human body was deserted, and the soul entered the second form, leaving the first body in a cataleptic state, to all appearance dead. The second hammer was either borrowed or created for the purpose. There was yet a third manner of producing this effect. It was by incantation. But then the form of the individual remained unaltered, though the eyes of all the beholders were charmed so that they could only perceive him under the selected form. Having assumed some bestial shape, the man who is i.e. Einhammer is only to be recognized by his eyes, which by no power can be changed. He then pursues his course, follows the instincts of the beast whose body he has taken, yet without quenching his own intelligence. He is able to do what the body of the animal can do, and to do what he, as a man, can do as well. He may fly or swim, if he is in the shape of bird or fish. If he has taken the form of a wolf, or if he goes on a gandreed or wolf's ride, he is full of the rage and malignity of the creatures whose powers and passions he has assumed. I will give a few instances of each of the three methods of changing bodies mentioned above. Freya and Frigg had their falcon dresses in which they visited different regions of the earth. And Loki is said to have borrowed these and to have then appeared so precisely like a falcon that he would have escaped detection but for the malicious twinkle of his eyes. In the Velundar Kvila is the following passage.
From the south flew the maidens athwart the gloom, Alvit the young to fix destinies. They on the sea strand sat them to rest, these damsels of the south, fair linen spun. One of them took eagle to press, fair maid in her dazzling arms. Another was Swanhild, who wore swan's feathers, and the third, their sister, pressed the white neck of Vlund.
The introduction of Sæmundr tells us that these charming young ladies were caught when they had laid their swan skins beside them on the shore, and were consequently not in a condition to fly. In like manner, werewolves' dresses used. The following curious passage is from the Wild Saga of the Volsungs. It is now to be told that Sigmund thought Sinfjotli too young to help him in his revenge, and he wished first to test his powers. So during the summer they plunged deep into the wood and slew men for their goods, and Sigmund saw that he was quite of the Volsung stock. Now it fell out that as they went through the forest collecting monies, that they lighted on a house in which were two men sleeping, with great gold rings on them. They had dealings with witchcraft, for wolf skins hung up in the house above them. It was the 10th day on which they might come out of their second state. They were king's sons. Sigmund and Sinfjotli got into the habits and could not get out of them again, and the nature of their original beasts came over them, and they howled as wolves. They learned both of them to howl. Now they went into the forest and each took his own course. They made the agreement together that they should try their strength against as many as 7 men, but not more, and that he who was ware of strife should utter his wolf's howl.
"Do not fail in this,"
said Sigmund,
"for you are young and daring, and men would be glad to chase you."
Now each went his own course, and after that they had parted, Sigmund found men, so he howled. And when Sinfjotli heard that, he ran up and slew them all. Then they separated, and Sinfjotli had not been long in the wood before he met with 11 men. He fell upon them and slew them every one. Then he was tired, and so he flung himself under an oak to rest. Up came Sigmund and said,
"Why did you not call out?"
Sinfjotli replied, "What was the need of asking your help to kill 11 men?" Sigmund flew at him and rent him so that he fell, for he had bitten through his throat. That day they could not leave their wolf forms. Sigmund laid him on his back and bare him home to the hall and sat beside him and said,
"Deuce, take the wolf forms."
Volsung Saga, C8. There is another curious story of a werewolf in the same saga which I must relate. Now he did as she requested, and hewed down a great piece of timber and cast it across the feet of those 10 brothers seated in a row in the forest. And there they sat all that day and on till night. And at midnight there came an old she-wolf out of the forest to them as they sat in the stalks, and she was both huge and grimly. Now she fell upon one of them and bit him to death, and after she had eaten him all up she went away. And next morning Signy sent a trusty man to her brothers to know how it had fared with them. When he returned, he told her of the death of one, and that grieved her much, for she feared it might fare thus with them all, and she would be unable to assist them. In short, 9 nights following came the she-wolf at midnight, and devoured them one after another till all were dead except Sigmund, and he was left alone. So when the 10th night came, Signy sent her trusty man to Sigmund, her brother, with honey in his hand, and said that he was to smear it over the face of Sigmund, and to fill his mouth with it. Now he went to Sigmund and did as he was bid, after which he returned home. And during the night came the same she-wolf, as was her wont, and reckoned to devour him like his brothers. Now she snuffed at him, where the honey was smeared, and began to lick his face with her tongue, and presently thrust her tongue into his mouth. He bore it ill and bit into the tongue of the she-wolf. She sprang up and tried to break loose, setting her feet against the stalk so as to snap it asunder. But he held firm and ripped the tongue out by the roots, so that it was the death of the wolf. It is the opinion of some men that this beast was the mother of King Siger, and that she had taken this form upon her through devilry and witchcraft. C5. There is another story bearing on the subject in the Hrolfs Saga Kraka, which is pretty. It is as follows. In the north of Norway, in upland dales, reigned a king called Hring, and he had a son named Bjorn. Now it fell out that the queen died, much lamented by the king and by all. The people advised him to marry again, and so he sent men south to get him a wife. A gale and fierce storm fell upon them, so that they had to turn the helm and run before the wind. And so they came north to Finnmark, where they spent the winter. One day they went inland and came to a house in which sat two beautiful women, who greeted them well and inquired whence they had come. They replied by giving an account of their journey and their errand, and then asked the women who they were, and why they were alone and far from the haunts of men, although they were so comely and engaging. The elder replied that her name was Ingibjorg, and that her daughter was called Hivit, and that she was the Finn king's sweetheart. The messengers decided that they would return home if Hivit would come with them and marry King Hring. She agreed, and they took her with them, and met the king, who was pleased with her, and had his wedding feast made, and said that he cared not, though she was not rich. But the king was very old, and that the queen soon found out. There was a carl who had a farm not far from the king's dwelling. He had a wife and a daughter, who was but a child, and her name was Bera. She was very young and lovely. Bjorn, the king's son, and Bera, the carl's daughter, were wont as children to play together, and they loved each other well. The carl was well-to-do. He had been out harrying in his young days, and he was a doughty champion. Bjorn and Bera loved each other more and more, and they were often together. Time passed, and nothing worth relating occurred, but Bjorn, the king's son, waxed strong and tall, and he was well skilled in all manly exercises. King Hring was often absent for long harrying foreign shores, and Hvit remained at home and governed the land. She was not liked of the people. She was always very pleasant with Bjorn, but he cared little for her. It fell out once that the king Hring went abroad, and he spake with his queen that Bjorn should remain at home with her to assist in the government, for he thought it advisable, the queen being haughty and inflated with pride. The king told his son Bjorn that he was to remain at home and rule the land with the queen. Bjorn replied that he disliked the plan and that he had no love for the queen. But the king was inflexible and left the land with a great following. Bjorn walked home after his conversation with the king and went up to his place, ill-pleased and red as blood. The queen came to speak with him and to cheer him, and spake friendly with him, but he bade her be off. She obeyed him that time. She often came to talk with him, and said how much pleasanter it was for them to be together than to have an old fellow like Hring in the house. Bjorn resented this speech and struck her a box in the ear, and bade her depart, and he spurned her from him. She replied that this was ill done to drive and thrust her away, and you think it better, Bjorn, to sweetheart a carl's daughter than to have my love and favor. A fine piece of condescension and a disgrace is to you. But before long something will stand in the way of your fancy and your folly. Then she struck at him with a wolf skin glove and said that he should become a rabid and grim wild bear, and you shall eat nothing but your father's sheep, which you shall slay for your food, and never shall you leave this state. After that, Bjorn disappeared, and none knew what had become of him, and men sought but found him not, as was to be expected. We must now relate how that the king's sheep were slaughtered, half a score at the time, and it was all the work of a grey bear, both huge and grimly. One evening it chanced that the Carl's daughter saw this savage bear coming towards her, looking tenderly at her, and she fancied that she recognized the eyes of Bjorn, the king's son, so she made a slight attempt to escape. Then the beast retreated, but she followed it till she came to a cave. Now when she entered the cave, there stood before her a man who greeted Bera, the Carl's daughter, and she recognized him, for he was Bjorn, Ring's son. Overjoyed were they to meet. So they were together in the cave a while, for she would not part from him where she had the chance of being with him. But he said that this was not proper, for she should be there by him, for by day he was a beast and by night a man. Hring returned from his harrying, and he was told the news of what had taken place during his absence, how that Bjorn his son had vanished, and also how that a monstrous beast was up the country and was destroying his flocks. The queen urged the king to have the beast slain, but he delayed a while. One night, as Bera and Bjorn were together, he said to her,
"Methinks tomorrow will be the day of my death, for they will come out to hunt me down. But for myself I care not, for it is little pleasure to live with this charm upon me, and my only comfort is that we are together. But now our union must be broken. I will give you the ring which is under my left hand. You will see the troop of hunters tomorrow coming to seek me. And when I am dead, go to the king and ask him to give you what is under the beast's left front leg. He will consent."
He spoke to her of many other things, till the bear's form stole over him. And he went forth a bear. She followed him and saw that a great body of hunters had come over the mountain ridges and had a number of dogs with them. The bear rushed away from the cavern, but the dogs and the king's men came upon him, and there was a desperate struggle. He wearied many men before he was brought to bay, and had slain all the dogs. But now they made a ring about him, and he ranged about it, but could see no means of escape, so he turned to where the king stood, and he seized a man who stood next him, and rent him asunder. Then was the bear so exhausted that he cast himself down flat, and at once the men rushed in upon him and slew him. The Carl's daughter saw this, and she went up to the king and said, "Sire, will thou grant me that which is under the bear's left foreshoulder?" The king consented. By this time his men had nearly flayed the bear. Bera went up and plucked away the ring and kept it, but none saw what she took, nor had they looked for anything. The king asked her who she was, and she gave a name, but not her true name. The king now went home, and Bera was in his company. The queen was very joyous and treated her well and asked who she was, but Bera answered as before. The queen now made a great feast and had the bear's flesh cooked for the banquet. The Carl's daughter was in the bower of the queen and could not escape, for the queen had a suspicion who she was. Then she came to Bera with a dish quite unexpectedly, and on it was bear's flesh, and she bade Bera eat it. She would not do so. "He is a marvel," said the queen. "You reject the offer which a queen herself deigns to make to you. Take it at once, or something worse will befall you." She bit before her, and she ate of that bite. The queen cut another piece and looked into her mouth. She saw that one little grain of the bite had gone down, but Bera spat out all the rest from her mouth and said she would take no more, though she were tortured or killed. "Maybe you have had sufficient," said the queen, and she laughed. Prolf's Saga, Kraka, C24-27, condensed. In the Faroe-Sisa song of Finnur Hin Fridi, we have the following verse.
"When this peril Finn saw that witchcraft did him harm, then he changed himself into a werewolf. He slew many thus."
The following is from the second Kvita of Helga Hundingsbana, strophe 31.
"May the blade bite, which thou brandishest, only on thyself when it chimes on thy head, then avenged will be the death of Helgi. When thou as a wolf wanderest in the woods, knowing nor fortune nor any pleasure, having no meat save rivings of corpses."
In all these cases, the change is of the form. We shall now come to instances in which the person who is changed has a double shape, and the soul animates one after the other. The Ynglinga Saga C7 says of Odin that he changed form. The bodies lay as though sleeping or dead, but he was a bird or a beast, a fish or a woman, and went in a twinkling to far distant lands, doing his own or other people's business. In like manner, the Danish King Harald sent a warlock to Iceland in the form of a whale, whilst his body lay stiff and stark at home. The already quoted saga of Hrolf Krake gives us another example where Birdvar Bjarki, in the shape of a huge bear, fights desperately with the enemy, which has surrounded the hall of his king, whilst his human body lies drunkenly beside the embers within. In the Vatnsdæla saga, there is a curious account of three Finns who were shut up in a hut for 3 nights, and ordered by Ingemund, a Norwegian chief, to visit Iceland and inform him of the lie of the country where he was to settle. Their bodies became rigid, and they sent their souls the errand, and on their awakening at the end of 3 days gave an accurate description of the Vatnsdal, in which Ingemund was eventually to establish himself. But the saga does not relate whether these Finns projected their souls into the bodies of birds or beasts. The third manner of transformation mentioned was that in which the individual was not changed himself, but the eyes of others were bewitched, so that they could not detect him, but saw him only under a certain form. Of this there are several examples in the sagas, as, for instance, in the Hromundar saga, Grisbonar, and in the Frostbrethra saga. But I will translate the most curious, which is that of Odd, Katla's son, in the Erbrigge saga, C20. Gerid, housewife in Mahavlith, sent word into Bolstad that she was aware of the fact that Odd, Katla's son, had hewn off Odd's hand. Now when Thorarin and Arnkell heard that, they rode from home with 12 men. They spent the night in Mahavlith and rode on next morning to Holt, and Odd was the only man in the house. Katla sat on the high seat spinning yarn, and she bade Odd sit beside her. Also she bade her woman sit each in her place and hold their tongues. For, she said, I shall do all the talking. Now when Arnkell and his company arrived, they walked straight in, and when they came into the chamber, Katla greeted Arnkell and asked the news. He replied that there was none, and he inquired after Odd. Katla said that he had gone to Breidavik. We shall ransack the house, though, quoth Arnkell. Be it so, replied Katla, and she ordered a girl to carry a light before them and unlock the different parts of the house. All they saw was Katla spinning yarn off her distaff. Now they search the house but find no Odd, so they depart. But when they had gone a little way from the garth, Arnkell stood still and said,
How know we but that Katla has hoodwinked us, and that the distaff in her hand was nothing more than Odd?
Not impossible, said Thorarin. Let us turn back. They did so, and when those at Holt Ra saw that they were returning, Katla said to her maids, Sit still in your places, Odd and I shall go out. Now, as they approached the door, she went into the porch and began to comb and clip the hair of her son Odd. Arnkell came to the door and saw where Katla was, and she seemed to be stroking her goat and disentangling its mane and beard and smoothing its wool. So he and his men went into the house, but found not Odd. Katla's distaff lay against the bench, so they thought that it could not have been Odd, and they went away. However, when they had come near the spot where they had turned before, Arnkell said,
Think you not that Odd may have been in the goat's form?
There is no saying, replied Thorarin, but if we turn back we will lay hands on Katla.
We can try our luck again,
quoth Arnkell,
and see what comes of it.
So they returned. Now when they were seen on their way back, Katla bade Odd follow her, and she led him to the ash heap, and told him to lie there and not to stir on any account. But when Arnkell and his men came to the farm, they rushed into the chamber and saw Katla seated in her place, spinning. She greeted them and said that their visits followed with rapidity. Arnkell replied that what she said was true. His comrades took the distaff and cut it in twain. Come now, said Katla. You cannot say when you get home that you have done nothing, for you have chopped up my distaff. Then Arnkell and the rest hunted high and low for Odd, but could not find him. Indeed, they saw nothing living about the place besides a boar pig which lay under the ash heap, so they went away once more. Well, when they got halfway to Malvalith, came Gerard to meet them with her workmen. They had not gone the right way to work in seeking Odd, she said, but she would help them. So they turned back again. Gerard had a blue cloak on her. Now when the party was seen and reported to Catla, and it was said that they were 13 in number and one had on a colored dress, Catla exclaimed, "That troll Gera is come. I shall not be able to throw a glamour over their eyes anymore." She started up from her place and lifted the cushion of the seat, and there was a hole and a cavity beneath. Into this she thrust Odd, clapped the cushion over him and sat down, saying she felt sick at heart. Now when they came into the room, there were small greetings. Gerard cast of her the cloak and went up to Catla and took the sealskin bag which she had in her hand and drew it over the head of Catla. Then Gerard bade them break up the seat. They did so and found Odd. Him they took and carried to Bulan's head, where they hanged him. But Catla they stoned to death under the headland. Chapter 4. The Origin of the Scandinavian Werewolf. One of the great advantages of the study of Old Norse or Icelandic literature is that insight given by it into the origin of worldwide superstitions. Norse tradition is transparent as glacier ice, and its origin is as unmistakable. Medieval mythology, rich and gorgeous, is a compound like Corinthian brass, into which many pure ores have been fused. Or it is a full, turbid river drawn from numerous feeders which had their sources in remote climes. It is a blending of primeval Celtic, Teutonic, Scandinavian, Italic, and Arab traditions, each adding a beauty, each yielding a charm, but each accretion rendering the analysis more difficult. Pacciuccelli says,
"The Anio flows into the Tiber. Pure as crystal it meets the tawny stream and is lost in it, so that there is no more Anio, but the united stream is all Tiber."
So is it with each tributary to the tide of medieval mythology. The moment it has blended its waters with the great and onward rolling flood, it is impossible to detect it with certainty. It has swollen the stream, but has lost its own identity. If we would analyze a particular myth, we must not go at once to the body of medieval superstition, but strike at one of the tributaries before its absorption. This we shall proceed to do, and in selecting Norse mythology, we come upon abundant material pointing naturally to the spot whence it has been derived. As glacial moraines indicate the direction which they have taken, and point to the mountains whence they have fallen, it will not be difficult for us to arrive at the origin of the northern belief in werewolves, and the data thus obtained will be useful in assisting us to elucidate much that would otherwise prove obscure in medieval tradition. Among the Old Norse, it was the custom for certain warriors to dress in the skins of the beast they had slain, and thus to give themselves an air of ferocity calculated to strike terror into the hearts of their foes. Such dresses are mentioned in some sagas, without there being any supernatural qualities attached to them. For instance, in the Njála, there is mention of a man, Egidjenni, in goatskin dress. Much in the same way do we hear of Harald Harfagri, having in his company a band of berserker, who were all dressed in wolfskins, Ofednir, and this expression, wolf-skin-coated, is met with as a man's name. Thus, in the Hómvarja saga, there is mention of a Bjorn, son of Ufedin, wolf-skin-coat, son of Ulfamir, wolf-shaped, son of Ulf, wolf, son of Ulfhammer, wolf-shaped, who could change forms. But the most conclusive passage is in the Vatnsdæla saga, and is as follows.
"Those berserkir, who were called Ufednir, had got wolf-skins over their male coats."
Chapter 16. In like manner, the word berserker, used of a man possessed of superhuman powers, and subject to excesses of diabolical fury, was originally applied to one of those doughty champions who went about in bear sarks, or habits made of bear skin over their armor. I am well aware that Bjorn Haldorsson's derivation of berserker, bear of sark, or destitute of clothing, has been hitherto generally received, but Sveabjorn Eagleson, an indisputable authority, rejects this derivation as untenable and substitutes for it that which I have adopted. It may well be imagined that a wolf or a bearskin would make a warm and comfortable great coat to a man whose manner of living required him to defy all weathers, and that the dress would not only give him an appearance of grimness and ferocity, likely to produce an unpleasant emotion in the breast of a foe, but also that of the thick fur might prove effectual in deadening the blows rained on him in conflict. The berserker was an object of aversion and terror to the peaceful inhabitants of the land, his avocation being to challenge quiet country farmers to a single combat. As the law of the land stood in Norway, a man who declined to accept a challenge forfeited all his possessions, even to the wife of his bosom, as a poltroon unworthy of the protection of the law, and every item of his property passed into the hands of his challenger. The berserker, accordingly, had the unhappy man at his mercy. If he slew him, the farmer's possessions became his, and if the poor fellow declined to fight, he lost all legal right to his inheritance. A berserker would invite himself to any feast and contribute his quota to the hilarity of the entertainment by snapping the backbone or cleaving the skull of some merrymaker who incurred his displeasure, or whom he might single out to murder for no other reason than a desire to keep his hand in practice. It may well be imagined that popular superstition went along with the popular dread of these wolf and bear-skinned rovers, and that they were believed to be endued with the force, as they certainly were with the ferocity of the beasts whose skins they wore. Nor would superstition stop there, but the imagination of the trembling peasants would speedily invest these unscrupulous disturbers of the public peace with the attributes hitherto appropriated to trolls and jotuns. The incident mentioned in the Volsung saga of the sleeping men being found with their wolfskins hanging to the wall above their heads is divested of its improbability if we regard these skins as worn over their armor, and the marvelous in the whole story is reduced to a minimum when we suppose that Sigmund and Sinjolfi stole these for the purpose of disguising themselves whilst they lived a life of violence and robbery. In a similar manner, the story of the northern Beauty and Beast in Hrolf's saga Kraka is rendered less improbable on the supposition that Bjorn was living as an outlaw among the mountain fastnesses in a bearskin dress, which would effectually disguise him, all but his eyes, which would gleam out of the sockets of his hideous visor, unmistakably human. His very name, Bjorn, signifies a bear, and these two circumstances may well have invested a kernel of historic fact with all the romance of fable. And if divested of these supernatural embellishments, the story would resolve itself into the very simple fact of there having been a King Hring of the Updales, who was at variance with his son and whose son took to the woods and lived a berserker life in company with his mistress till he was captured and slain by his father. I think that the circumstance insisted upon by the saga writers of the eyes of the person remaining unchanged is very significant and points to the fact that the skin was merely drawn over the body as a disguise. But there was other ground for superstition to fasten on to the berserker and invest them with supernatural attributes. No fact in the connection with the history of the Northmen is more firmly established on reliable evidence than that of the berserker rage being a species of diabolical possession. The berserker were said to work themselves up into a state of frenzy, in which a demoniacal power came over them, impelling them to acts from which in their sober senses they would have recoiled. They acquired superhuman force, and were as invulnerable and as insensible to pain as the Jansenist convulsionists of St. Medard. No sword would wound them, no fire would burn them, a club alone could destroy them by breaking their bones or crushing in their skulls. Their eyes glared as though a flame burned in the sockets, they ground their teeth and frothed at the mouth. They nod at their shield rims, and they're said to have sometimes bitten them through, and as they rushed into conflict, they yelped as dogs or howled as wolves. According to the unanimous testimony of the Old Norse historians, the berserker rage was extinguished by baptism, and as Christianity advanced, the number of these berserkir decreased. But it must not be supposed that this madness or possession came only on those persons who predisposed themselves to be attacked by it. Others were afflicted with it, who vainly struggled against its influence, and who deeply lamented their own liability to be seized with these terrible excesses of frenzy. Such was Thorir, Ingimund's son, of whom it is said in the Vatnsdala saga,
that at times there came over Thorir berserker fits, and it was considered a sad misfortune to such a man, as they were quite beyond control.
The manner in which he was cured is remarkable, pointing as it does to the craving in the heathen mind for a better and more merciful creed. Thorgrim of Kornsau had a child by his concubine, Veridir, and by order of his wife the child was carried out to perish. The brothers, Thorstein and Thorir, often met, and it was now the turn of Thorstein to visit Thorir, and Thorir accompanied him homeward. On their way, Thorstein asked Thorir which he thought was the first among the brethren. Thorir answered that the reply was easy, for
you are above us in all discretion and talent. Jokull is the best in all perilous adventures, but I,
he added,
I am the least worth of us, brothers, because the berserker fits come over me quite against my will, and I wish that you, my brother, with your shrewdness, would devise some help for me.
Thorstein said, I have heard that our kinsman Thorgrim has just suffered his little babe to be carried out at the instigation of his wife. That is ill done. I think also that it is a grievous matter for you to be different in nature from other men. Thorir asked how he could obtain release from his affliction. Then said Thorstein, now will I make a vow to him who created the sun, for I ween that he is most able to take the ban of you, and I will undertake for his sake in return to rescue the babe and to bring it up for him, till he who created man shall take it to himself. For this I reckon he will do. After this they left their horses and sought the child, and a thrall of Thorir had found it near the Merrim River. They saw that a kerchief had been spread over its face, but it had rumpled it up over its nose. The little thing was all but dead, but they took it up and fitted it home to Thorir's house, and he brought the lad up and called him Thorkell Rumple. As for the berserker fits, they came on him no more. Chapter 37. But the most remarkable passages bearing on our subject will be found in the Egla. There was a man, Ulf the Wolf by name, son of Jalfi and Halbera. Ulf was a man so tall and strong that the like of him was not to be seen in the land at that time. And when he was young, he was out Viking expeditions and harrying. He was a great landed proprietor. It was his wont to rise early and to go about the men's work or to the smithies and inspect all his goods and his acres. And sometimes he talked with those men who wanted his advice, for he was a good adviser, he was so clear-headed. However, every day when it drew towards dusk, he became so savage that few dared exchange a word with him, for he was given to dozing in the afternoon. People said that he was much given to changing form, Hamrammr, so he was called the Evening Wolf, Kveldiver. Chapter 1. In this and the following passages, I do not consider Hamrammr to have its primary signification of actual transformation, but simply to mean subject to fits of diabolical possession, under the influence of which the bodily powers were greatly exaggerated. I shall translate pretty freely from this most interesting saga, as I consider that the description given in it of Kveldulf in his fits greatly elucidates our subject. Kveldulf and Skallagrim got news during summer of an expedition. Skallagrim was the keenest sighted of men, and he caught sight of the vessel of Halvard and his brother and recognized it at once. He followed their course and marked the haven into which they entered at even. Then he returned to his company and told Kveldulf of what he had seen. Then they busked them and got ready both their boats. In each they put 20 men, Kveldulf steering one and Skallagrim the other, and they rowed in quest of the ship. Now when they came to the place where it was, they lay to Halvard, and his men had spread an awning over the deck and were asleep. Now when Kveldulf and his party came upon them, the watchers who were seated at the end of the bridge sprang up and called to the people on board to wake them up, for there was danger in the wind. So Halvard and his men sprang to arms. Then came Kveldulf over the bridge and Skallagrim with him into the ship. Kveldulf had in his hand a cleaver, and he bade his men go through the vessel and hack away the awning. But he pressed on to the quarterdeck. It is said that the werewolf fit came over him and many of his companions. They slew all the men who were before them. Skallagrim did the same as he went round the vessel. He and his father paused not till they had cleared it. Now when Kveldulf came upon the quarterdeck, he raised his cleaver and smote Halvard through helm and head, so that the haft was buried in the flesh, but he dragged it to him so violently that he whisked Halvard into the air and flung him overboard. Skallagrim charged the forecastle and slew Sigtrygg. Many men flung themselves overboard, but Skallagrim's men took to the boat and rowed about, killing all they found. Thus perished Halvard with 50 men. Skallagrim and his party took the ship and all the goods which had belonged to Halvard, and fitted it with the wares to their own vessel, and then exchanged ships, lading their capture but quitting their own. After which they filled their old ship with stones, brake it up, and sank it. A good breeze sprang up, and they stood out to sea. It is said of these men in the engagement who were werewolves, or those on whom came the berserker rage, that as long as the fit was on them, no one could oppose them, they were so strong. But when it had passed off, they were feebler than usual. It was the same with Kveldulf when the werewolf fit went off him. He then felt the exhaustion consequent on the fight, and he was so completely done up that he was obliged to take to his bed. In like manner, Skallagrim had his fits of frenzy, taking after his amiable father. Thord and his companions were opposed to Skallagrim in the game, and they were too much for him, he wearied, and the game went better with them. But at dusk, after sunset, it went worse with Egil and Thord, for Skallagrim became so strong that he caught up Thord and cast him down, so that he broke his bones, and that was the death of him. Then he caught at Egil. Thorgerd Brauk was the name of a servant of Skallagrim who had been foster mother to Egil. She was a woman of great stature, strong as a man, and a bit of a witch. Brauk exclaimed,
Skallagrim, are you now falling upon your son?
Then Skallagrim let go of his hold on Egil and clutched at her. She started aside and fled. Skallagrim followed. They ran out upon Digraness, and she sprang off the headland into the water. Skallagrim cast after her a huge stone, which struck her between the shoulders, and she never rose after it. The place is now called Brauk's Sound. Chapter 40. Let it be observed that in these passages from the Egla, the words ad hamaz, hamramer, etc. are used without any intention of conveying the idea of a change of bodily shape, though the words taken literally assert it. For they are derived from hammer, a skin or habit, a word which has its representatives in other Aryan languages, and is therefore a primitive word expressive of the skin of a beast. The Sanskrit karma, the Hindustani kam, hide or skin, and kamra, leather, the Persian game, clothing, disguise, the Gothic ham or hams, skin, and even the Italian camicia and the French camice are cognate words. It seems probable, according that the verb ad hamaz was first applied to those who wore the skins of savage animals and went about the country as freebooters, but that popular superstition soon invested them with supernatural powers, and they were supposed to assume the form of the beasts in whose skins they were disguised. The verb then acquired the significance to become a werewolf, to change shape. It did not stop there, but went through another change of meaning and was finally applied to those who were afflicted with paroxysms of madness or demoniacal possession. This was not the only word connected with werewolves which helped on the superstition. The word vargr, A wolf had a double significance, which would be the means of originating many a werewolf story. Vargr is the same as Uargr, restless, Argr being the same as the Anglo-Saxon Urg. Vargr had its double signification in Norse. It signified a wolf and also a godless man. This Vargr is the English word in the word werewolf and the garou or varou in French. The Danish word for a werewolf is varulf, the Gothic veraulf. In the Romans de Guerin, it is lu varou, sanglante beste. In the Vita Saint Hildefond by Gautier de Coincy, Sir Lou Deve, Sir Lou Garol, Ce sont diable que sol, ne pointes trois, de no mordre. Translated to English, those mad wolves, those werewolves, they are devils who alone cannot keep from biting us. Here the loup garou is a devil. The Anglo-Saxons regarded him as an evil man. Werg, a scoundrel, Gothic vargs, a fiend. But very often the word meant no more than an outlaw. Pluquet, in his Contes Populaires, tells us that the ancient Norman laws said of the criminals condemned to outlawry for certain offenses, vargus esto, be an outlaw. In like manner, the Lex Ruparior, tit 87, vargus sit hoc expulsus. In the laws of Canute, he is called Verwulf. Leges Canuti Schmidt, I 148. And the Salic law, tit 57, orders, si quis corpus iam sepultum effoderit, aut expoliaverit, vargusit, if anyone shall have dug up or despoiled an already buried corpse, let him be a varg. Sidonius Apollinaris says,
unam feminam quam forte vargorum ocenim nomine endiganas latrunculus nun cupant.
As though the common name by which those who lived a freebooter life were designated was Varg. In like manner, Palgrave assures us in his Rise and Progress of the English Commonwealth that among the Anglo-Saxons an outlaw, outlaw, or outlaw was said to have the head of a wolf. If then the term Vargr was applied at one time to a wolf, at another to an outlaw who lived the life of a wild beast, away from the haunts of men, he shall be driven away as a wolf and chased so far as men chase wolves farthest, was the legal form of sentence. It is certainly no matter of wonder that stories of outlaws should have become surrounded with mythical accounts of their transformation into wolves. But the very idiom of the Norse was calculated to foster this superstition. The Icelanders had curious expressions which are sufficiently likely to have produced misconceptions. Snorri not only relates that Odin changed himself into another form, but he adds that by his spells he turned his enemies into boars. In precisely the same manner does a hag, Ljot, in the Vansdala saga, say that she could have turned Thorstein and Jokull into boars to run about with the wild beasts. Chapter 26. And the expression Verda et Gjalti, or et Gjaltum, to become a boar, is frequently met with in the sagas. Thereupon came Thorarin and his men upon them, and Nagli led the way. But when he saw weapons drawn, he was frightened and ran away up the mountain and became a boar. And Thorarin and his men took to run so as to help Nagli, lest he should tumble off the cliffs into the sea. Erbrigia Saga, Chapter 18. A similar expression occurs in the Gisla Saga, Sursunar, page 50. In the Hrolfs Saga Kraka, we meet with a troll in boar's shape, to whom divine honors are paid. And in the Kjalna Singa Saga, Chapter 15, men are likened to boars. Then it began to fare with them as it fares with boars when they fight each other, for in the same manner drop their foam. The true signification of Verda et Gjalti is to be in such a state of fear as to lose the senses, but it is sufficiently peculiar to have given rise to superstitious stories. I have dwelt at some length on the northern myths relative to werewolves and animal transformations, because I have considered the investigation of these all important towards the elucidation of the truth which lies at the bottom of medieval superstition, and which is nowhere so obtainable as through the Norse literature. As may be seen from the passages quoted above at length, and from an examination of those merely referred to, the result arrived at is pretty conclusive, and may be summed up in very few words. The whole superstructure of fable and romance relative to transformation into wild beasts reposes simply on this basis of truth: that among the Scandinavian nations there existed a form of madness or possession, under the influence of which men acted as though they were changed into wild and savage brutes, howling, foaming at the mouth, ravening for blood and slaughter, ready to commit any act of atrocity, and as irresponsible for their actions as the wolves and bears, in whose skins they often equipped themselves. The manner in which this fact became invested with supernatural adjuncts I have also pointed out, to wit, the change in the significance of the word designating the madness, the double meaning of the word vargr, and above all the habits and appearance of the maniacs. We shall see instances of berserker rage reappearing in the Middle Ages and late down into our own times, not exclusively in the North but throughout France, Germany, and England. And instead of rejecting the accounts given by chroniclers as fabulous, because there is much connected with them which seems to be fabulous, we shall be able to refer them to their true origin. It may be accepted as an axiom that no superstition of general acceptance is destitute of a foundation of truth. And if we discover the myth of the werewolf to be widely spread, not only throughout Europe but through the whole world, we may rest assured that there is a solid core of fact round which popular superstition has crystallized. And the fact is the existence of a species of madness during the excesses of which the person afflicted believes himself to be a wild beast and acts like a wild beast. In some cases, this madness amounts apparently to positive possession, and the diabolical acts into which the possessed is impelled are so horrible that the blood curdles in reading them, and it is impossible to recall them without a shudder. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.